Hello, everybody. It is John Pollock and Wei Ting here with your Extreme Rules post show. How are you, Wei? Are you okay?
I'm perfectly fine. Yeah, no, it's always just a bit of a rush trying to get here, you know, right after these shows end. But I'm perfectly good. How are you, John?
I'm doing well. We are coming off of WWE's Extreme Rules event from Philadelphia that we are going to be getting into. And we will be getting to your phone calls after. If you are joining us from the Double Double Ice Cap or Espresso levels of the Post Wrestling Cafe, the phone lines will be open afterwards. You would have gotten a message in your inbox with the link to join us later. So I'll mention that off the top and taking your super chats. So hello to everybody joining us in the YouTube chat as we speak.
What's going on, YouTube? Hello, everybody. And hello to all of you guys listening to us after the fact. Happy to be back here for another WWE Premium live event.
I'm in such a great mood.
So, really? Why?
Oh yeah. So today, you know, the last 24 hours, Wei, I've jumped on the bandwagon. You know what? These Toronto Blue Jays, they've really won me over. I went to a game in the summer. I've been following them from afar, so I just jumped on board. And then today, watching the game, and it was like bottom of the fifth. It was like me and Max are watching it. It's 8-1. Like, cool. They've got this in the bag. So, yeah, it's 1-1 now, and I guess they'll be playing game 3. Turn the TV off after the fifth because it was just they were so far ahead. So I can't wait to watch tomorrow's game. I think that it's going to be just such a record-breaking game when it comes to a game 3, and the Mariners, I don't know. I don't think they're going to be able to take it to them because the Jays just killed them for 6 innings, and it was just a wipeout.
Of course, yeah. Well, I saw you tweet, Jays! And I remember the game was on, and I was like, oh, they must be doing great. So that's when I turned the game on, John. Oh. And from that point on, it was a disaster.
A disaster. Dude. They just self-destructed. I literally, I came back like 45 minutes later, and dude, it's like, it's fucking like 9-9. I was like, how did they screw this up so much? Like, there is no anger in me at all. If you blow a 7-run lead, you don't deserve to win. You were the worst team. You should not be going on. If you can't do this in the wild card, what do you think you're going to do in the division series? They got eliminated. Good riddance. Sorry, Blue Jays. It was one of the biggest comebacks in postseason history. There was like 3 other teams in the history of Major League Baseball that have had this large of a comeback. They were up 8-1.
Mm-hmm.
Unreal.
Yeah, no, it's I mean, it feels just like a pretty typical Toronto sports story, honestly. I don't know, in some ways kind of poetic for I don't know, the reputation that I think our sports teams have in the city.
Honest to God, when I saw that they lost, I didn't even realize it was a best of 3 series. I thought had at least one. I thought it was best of 5 in the wild card. I didn't realize it was best of 3. They have to play back-to-back. They would have had to play tomorrow. It's like 3 games in 3 days. Like, they don't kid around with the wild card. Like, yeah, you get the postseason, but boy, you better be ready.
That's why they call it a wild card, John. It's crazy.
Yeah, so, well, there you go. In and out, 2 days of the playoffs. Man. This was not 2015. This was not for Toronto.
Not quite.
Anyway,
next year,
always another year to come. So go Jays. Tonight we're going to be getting into Extreme Rules. Off the top, I guess, you know, the headline coming out of the show, it was in fact the much expected return of Bray Wyatt at the close of the show. We're just minutes removed. I'm hoping that this crowd that sold out this arena, and there was like a big upswing in tickets over the last week. This had already been a really well-selling event, but definitely this White Rabbit tease did move tickets. So I hope as we're speaking, this crowd got a little bit more than just his face that we got at the end. I hope this crowd got something.
Well, what do you think people were expecting, you know, beyond seeing the entrance, beyond the confirmation that it's Bray Wyatt's return and beyond seeing the face? Like, they're not expecting a match. You know, what else are they expecting?
Maybe a Bray Wyatt experience of some sort.
An experience, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm sure all the reports are coming in right now if there's anything further beyond I think what was seen on screen. But the Fiend is back. Now, is he going to be the Fiend? Is he going to be some other iteration? He did show up with a new mask and then he proceeded to take the mask off, revealing sort of like his dreadlock look. But Yeah. Well, should we talk about that first, or do you want to talk about that at the end?
Yeah, we can start at the beginning. I mean, they had teases throughout the show, if you were paying attention to it. Like, subtly worked into the show. That was, you know, they had, like, the image of the rabbit that you saw on SmackDown. I actually thought like, watching SmackDown this morning, that it was, you know, that was all the fun and games for the Waiting crowd. That was the last few weeks. Last night was about making it as painfully obvious. And I think that, you know, you've done the whole scavenger hunt. Now it's time to promote the show and that make it clear that he's coming. And I thought they achieved that on Friday. So tonight they did that. They had the shaky cam outside when the rabbit was taking pretty much just dropping some clues throughout the show to keep you remembering about the whole tease of that. And I thought that it was going to be more of a struggle in that main event, because at the beginning you had the We Want Wyatt chance, and after sitting through a 30-minute I Quit match, I think this audience, like, to them, the main event was Bray Wyatt. It was not any of the six matches.
Certainly, yeah. You know, we haven't obviously talked about our thoughts on the matches themselves, but I mean, I certainly sensed a bit more of a tepid reaction for some of those later matches, or at least the last match. And I do, you know, wonder if a lot of that was because of people's expectations for Bray Wyatt interrupting.
Oh, I have a lot to say about the Fight Pit match.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, you know, he's here. What did you think about the reveal? So we had, the closing signature, which is a Triple H signature.
As soon as that came up, it was like, okay, yeah. Uncle Paul is ready here for his angle alert.
Lights went out. Michael Cole was like, are we still on the air?
God, he's, yeah, sometimes it's the hardest thing, I think, for announcers to convey is pretend like it's real. And it's sometimes it's a very difficult.
Well, we've seen from the WWE playbook, oftentimes the best thing to do is just to not say anything at all. And I'm a little surprised they had the announcers try to talk through it a little bit. Nonetheless, lights went out. And I think at that point, everybody knew what was up. You know, you saw the light, all the cell phones come up. And then you heard sort of a minor key version of he's got the whole world in his hands, and then cut to various people dressed up as the Firefly Funhouse characters. I believe we saw Huskis, Abby. Who else?
The whole crew. They showed the Fiend in the front row, and the crowd went nuts for that one. And then from there,
seemingly to suggest like maybe the Fiend is sort of like one of the past characters, right? Rather than his new one. Okay.
Yeah, they had this setup with a door, and then we go inside sort of an abandoned Firefly Funhouse that's full of cobwebs, and then we go to a television set, and through the static images you see the image of this new face with a mask, and then the door in the arena opens, and it was actually shot very well, where you see the lantern that's covering Bray's face, and he comes out. The crowd sees the lantern and just goes nuts, and then moves the lantern. It's Bray under a mask. Whole crowd starts chanting holy shit, and then he removes the mask and you see Bray Wyatt, and then we just cut to what looks to be a new logo for him, and that was the end of the show. Kind of get, if you tuned in, like, you got your reveal at the end, and this should send you presumably to SmackDown. I don't know if they'll do anything on Raw with him, but I guess that will be the follow-up this week. I mean, it just seems like it's been a SmackDown angle.
They've aired those videos everywhere.
Okay, well, maybe Monday then. I guess
I feel like because, you know, today was so brief of really sort of an appearance from Bray Wyatt, that I think Raw will probably be the place you'd want to like build off of that momentum a little bit more with a bit more presence from him. There is no real brand split anymore, John. So I think you're probably going to see some presence on both of them.
The Bray Wyatt contract negotiations have been going on between Raw and SmackDown, the fictitious GMs on each side, recruiting this top tier attraction. Yeah. But you know, all the lead up has been great. The chase has been done very well. Now it's the execution. Now to me is the heavy lifting. Now is the very difficult part. There will be a honeymoon phase for Bray Wyatt, but this is going to be the most analyzed character in professional wrestling. And there is going to be, I feel, a dividing line of people that are going to love that he's back, hate that he's back, and hopefully enough in between that they're like, now is the real test to bring a character like this into what has been largely a much more kind of serious approach that we have seen by and large under this regime, with a few exceptions of like the Dexter Loomis variety. But this is taking that example to a 10.
Sure. Yeah. More serious, but I think you can, there's a way of doing this that is more serious, John. You know, even though it's a supernatural character that wouldn't exist in real life, I think there's a way to tell the story that feels a bit more adult and a bit more sophisticated, which I'm hoping the teasers, are, if they're an indication, are telling us that, you know, under different hands, maybe under a different sort of a final
murder set. This guy and he comes back to life after being burnt to death on television. Yeah.
The transition from, like, you know, all the pre-produced stuff to a real world setting is always going to be the most challenging thing, and especially the transition from, you know, like a very compelling character on screen in pre-production to a wrestling match is going to be the biggest challenge. How are they going to portray his matches to make him feel supernatural without being overly hokey? You know, like we've seen with The Fiend over and over again. I'm curious to see it. I'm curious to see what his first program is going to be.
I think that's a big question. Like, who draws first up with Bray Wyatt? That has to essentially be a sacrificial lamb to reintroduce the character. It's like, you're not like a lot of it is. And on top of it, like, this character is going to be embraced as a babyface at the beginning, whether that is your long-term goal or not. That is how he is going to be received immediately. So that would become very difficult if it's a babyface being thrown at him on top of things. It's a lot, but this to me is one of the larger creative challenges we are going to see Paul Levesque have of a story to tell involving a character that was, he seems to be very fondly remembered, but in real time, was a character that I think was of grand frustration to many people and many performers that have also spoken about the challenges of working with this fiend character and the stories that they had to go to.
Yeah. Yeah. And hopefully this time they've learned from whatever mistakes, and there are plenty of them that were made, you know, during his last run. You know, something I will say though about like Wyndham Rotunda is that like the man has been very good at reinventing himself. And he, despite, I think, all the maybe bad memories we've had of some of the last run, I think this feels like it might be the hottest that he's been. Like, would you say, John? Like, I always think back to like WrestleMania 30, like in New Orleans, or like what was that?
Yeah.
Like, where everybody was dressed up as, you know, the Bray Wyatt that week. Everybody had a fedora and a Hawaiian shirt, and that felt like that was when he was sort of at his, you know, peak in terms of interest. I would argue that, you know, the past month has kind of rivaled that in terms of, like, you know,
I mean, look at this. I'm not going to say he was the sole reason that they sold out this building, but he moved tickets. We had that SmackDown number a few weeks ago, and like, so far, like, he is showing like these teases. You can only go by the evidence that we have so far is that this audience has cared about this character coming back, and the reintroduction of him has been done very well. But that's only you only have a shelf life to do the teases, and now it's the real work begins.
We're all incredibly excited, I think, about the potential that, you know, a man with this level of creativity, and not just a man, but, you know, let's also mention the people that he's working with, including Rob Fee, who has been reported to be, you know, one of the architects of this entire angle. There's incredible potential for like incredible storytelling that has not been seen too often, if at all, before in professional wrestling. But does it require the right editor to, you know, make it transferable to a professional wrestling setting that's not too complicated for an audience or not too confusing for an audience?
Yeah, as well. And, you know, the handling of the character, whether it's a babyface presentation, a heel, I think everyone is at most. I feel like there's an audience that even ones that did not enjoy the Fiend run, it's at least a blank slate. It's you're not just bringing back a character, but it's also in a very different system that he is coming back in. But I just feel this is going to be the most scrutinized character moving forward, because there's pro and cons to the version. But number one, it's you know, we can look at these numbers, and I have no doubt this is going to be a huge merchandise seller for the company right out of the gate with the, you know, the new logo that they've introduced, like all of this stuff. And that was one of the reasons I think everyone was surprised that they ended up cutting bait on the character, because as much as you might want to scrutinize, this was a character that, I mean, God, they've left that Lily doll with Alexa Bliss. I mean, it tells you, like, this was a concept that did move merchandise. There were people buying that Bloody Fiend championship belt. That thing was going for like $5,000 or something.
Yeah, yeah. Again, you know, this man has been incredible at marketing himself and making himself look cool. Does it translate to in-ring product? We shall see. I just want to go to one super chat here. And of course, this comes to us from John Cena, who appeared with you yesterday on our Impact Bound for Glory post show in the Post Wrestling Cafe. Cena sends $4 just to say, unmask the characters, Abigail being Nikki Cross. Do you think the characters dressed up as the various Firefly Funhouse people, is that a tease about them actually being, you know, significant characters as a part of a faction of real life people now with Bray?
Yeah. I mean, that idea has been floated out about having all these characters like come into human form and taking different characters and placing them that way. It's a way to go. And then it's placing kind of a group with Bray Wyatt. It's you could do that. There's certainly the people that could be better off being thrust into a main group like this.
Who's the guy that gets to dress up as this? Ramblin' Rabbit.
Massey?
You think so? That quickly? I think Omos would be a great Ramblin' Rabbit.
Okay, yeah. Lots of candidates, I'm sure, that people can throw out there. Before we get into the actual review, also want to make mention, at the GCW show tonight, Nick Gage's career continues. He defeated Jon Moxley to win the GCW title. So Jon Moxley losing to Nick Gage. So that was a very interesting outcome to look at after the announcement of Jon Moxley's new contract with AEW and a lot of speculation about if it would impact the outcome. And it seemed that there was people back and forth looking at the potential outcome here, because it seemed a lot assumed that this was going to be the end of Nick Gage's career, quite the opposite. And then he addressed the crowd afterwards. And we will have a report from John Pine up on the site probably overnight, covering the entire show. But that was the main result coming out of Atlantic City on Saturday night. But you and I have not seen the match yet, but it was airing during Extreme Rules.
I saw the finish, and it involved Stokely Hathaway.
The firm showing up, yes.
And Morrissey.
Morrissey and Stokely Hathaway.
That is correct. Yeah. You know, so much of this, I think we wonder if it at all changed with Moxley's new contract. But, you know, the use of Stokely and Morrissey seems to suggest an ongoing relationship between AEW and GCW, perhaps. So maybe GCW continues to be one of those promotions that's an affiliate that Moxley can continue to work with.
Yeah, I mean, it'll remain to be seen if that is part of the new contract or not. That part hasn't been really defined yet of like what that's going to preclude Jon Moxley from participating in with this new deal that is set for 5 years. So we'll shift over, though, to Extreme Rules. Huge turnout for this show. WrestleTix this afternoon having over 13,200 tickets. So this was pretty much a sellout at the Wells Fargo Center. So that was a tremendous amount of tickets that they sold for this show. Kickoff show just had chatter for an hour with Kevin Patrick, Booker T, Jerry Lawler, and Peter Rosenberg. And the pay-per-view itself began with a spelling bee-themed opening with a child who was given the word extreme by adjudicator Paul Heyman. And he's asking for the definition of the word and to use it in a sentence. And all I have to say is that if I got extreme at a spelling bee, I mean, not the toughest word I would say that would require such specificity when it comes to the definition. I mean, this is a layup. You're at a spelling bee like that. That should be in your wheelhouse to just be able to rattle off the top of your head. Should you not? This was not, this was like a 12-year-old. I would say you should be able to spell extreme by the time you're 12.
I mean, we don't know what grade this child is. He may be just an older looking kindergartner. I mean,
could be a wrestling fan where they butcher spellings of all these words and spells it with an X or God knows, uppercase middle letter of the word, like WWE loves to do. So
wrestling spelling bee, I think, would be a fun game. You know, like spell Dozovich.
Hurricane Rana. Do you know how many people would be
just Enziguri?
E N Z U I G I R E.
I don't even know. I mess that up all the time.
Well, he never actually spelled the word. Or actually, he did. He did in this opening. So he got it. Extreme. That's, you get to go to level two, I guess, whatever that is. Michael Cole and Corey Graves are the announcers, and Cole notes that we're going to be calling every one of these events for the future. Variety told you so. So get used to it. Michael Cole and Corey Graves. Although I wonder if the premium live events will switch up when Pat McAfee comes back, because I imagine Cole and McAfee is the number one team that they view.
Yeah, clearly they love Pat McAfee. You know, I think they love the celebrity value that man brings. So I imagine he'll definitely have a full, a spot there whenever he wants it. Question is if it's at the expense of somebody else moving out, or if he becomes a third man as a part of a third man booth. I don't know. I get the sense that maybe they don't want to play too many musical chairs, and not to overcomplicate things. But
they do it every year. It seems every year they just mess up these commentary teams just to do it. Like they just switch everybody over.
But I like the idea of having sort of like a one team, for a pay-per-view in essentially sort of like your A broadcasters on either team in a Cole and Graves. They have good chemistry together, and clearly both of them are more than up on, storylines across both brands. So I like maybe a sort of like a bit of consistency, at least throughout these 3 hours.
As the Brawling Brutes make their entrance for the first match, this is where we cut to the White Rabbit video and then cut back. It's not acknowledged by the commentators. So the good old-fashioned Donnybrook match is up first between the Brawling Brutes and Imperium. And we've got the whole bar set up on the floor where the photo of Sheamus's grandfather gets destroyed by Ludwig Kaiser. And we see Holland lift up and dump Kaiser and Vinci after the Brawling Brutes are being mauled. And there's an Imperial bomb to the floor onto Holland. Long beatdown spot. And then Sheamus emerges after he had been laid out and dropped on the bar. So he drops Kaiser and Vinci on the floor. And we get Gunther sending Holland and Butch out. Irish curse backbreaker and applies the cloverleaf when Kaiser breaks that up with a shillelagh and destroys it over Sheamus's back. Imperium then clear the announcer's desk and they go for another Imperial bomb, but are stopped by Holland. Butch does a moonsault off the barrels, and then Gunther nails Sheamus with a shillelagh for a two count and goes for the power bomb, but Butch returns, snapping the fingers, and they hold Gunther as Sheamus hits him with the shillelagh. Butch and Holland join in, so they've got three shillelaghs to attack with, and Sheamus hits the Celtic cross, putting Gunther through the desk, and they hold up Vinci for a brogue kick, big pop as Sheamus hits the brogue and pins him. 17 minutes and 50 seconds to start the show on a pretty high note with this. These six that you can mix and match, and it seems to be a great match every time out. And I think Ridge Holland is improving a lot just being associated with these others and routinely being in these matches.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. I think the idea to do this six-man after the singles match is certainly a bit unique, but obviously, given the circumstances of them wanting a big match for their season premiere, you can understand it. But I did have my questions about how important this trios match would feel after you've already done the singles match the night prior. And the answer was that the singles match made this match feel more important because the singles match was so good last night. So, the Cardiff match was great, but like, I think I wonder how many people ultimately saw it. Last night, it was their season premiere on Fox and arguably the biggest, audience that match could have possibly had. And so it felt like everybody tonight was well aware of the quality of match that Gunther and Sheamus had last night. And that momentum carried directly on from, the last thing we saw on SmackDown to the first thing we saw in this pay-per-view. I thought match did a great job of setting up memorable moments within every meeting between Sheamus and Gunther was really well built up in anticipation and, like building up to those like big, hard physical exchanges. I thought they all felt very satisfying. It's a name that's kind of really made it same in style. And it extended wonderfully from the singles match to, the rest of the faction as well. It's quickly becoming like one of my favorite feuds in wrestling, the faction warfare between these two.
Yeah, I thought this was great. I think you could argue, if you want to argue this was match of the night, I think you'd have a lot of agreement from people. I thought that this was like just a tremendous start to the show. They all have great chemistry together. I don't want to see them like just rely on this, that you could put this six man on every other week and it's going to be a great match every time out. But I hope that they do have, I think that there's more story to be told here between them to continue this, but really strong opener.
And the number of trios that are, becoming prominent in WWE right now is very notable. We just saw the return of the debut of Legado del Fantasma. Of course, we have the Bloodline, which, is more than a stable or more than a trios, but certainly you can break them off and maybe more to come as well. So
how many titles does Paul Levesque have in his office desk?
Well, is there an All Atlantic Championship coming soon, maybe?
Well, we'll see which ocean he wants to
All Pacific
cultivate. Yes, he will get the other oceans. Megan Morant is with The Miz, so this was The Miz's actual birthday. So he showed up to this pay per view to meet with Paul Levesque to make sure that his birthday celebration tomorrow night doesn't get ruined by Dexter Lumis. So then he runs into Gritty, the Philadelphia Flyers mascot, and Gritty has the custom shirt that they have designed for Philadelphia, and he throws the shirt down and says, "This is what I think of the team and your city." And this would lead to many more vignettes throughout the night involving The Miz, who like ditched his family on his own birthday to come do to meet with Paul Levesque.
Well, hopefully maybe the family tagged along,
he was on the phone with her later. Like he wasn't with his family.
Yeah.
Well, so he doesn't want to ruin his celebration tomorrow, but his actual birthday, he was fully willing to just ruin by just coming backstage and needing like 2.5 hours to find Paul Levesque's office.
Maybe there was an obligation, WWE just wanted everybody to be there. Maybe he had to do some media.
Okay. Liv Morgan and Ronda Rousey in an Extreme Rules match for the SmackDown Women's Championship. A very mixed reaction for Rousey coming out in the pink gi jacket that they mentioned. It's going to be Jean LaBelle's memorial service tomorrow. And Corey points out that she's got They Live inspired gear with Obey and Submit written on her gear. So,
yeah. I love the idea, obviously, given the Roddy Piper connection, and I wondered if some of it had to do with the fact that she was facing an opponent named Liv.
That's what I thought.
Which actually was quite clever, but I didn't think the outfit looked that great.
It was really hard to see the Obey because it was black on black, so you really couldn't – you could only see the Submit, really, unless you were very much looking for it.
With a movie as iconic visually as They Live, I think they could have had really, really so much fun doing They Live-inspired gear. But I mean, this was really, you wouldn't have been able to tell it was They Live.
Maybe this was supposed to be an homage to the fight scene in They Live.
What, just like never ending the match, you mean?
I mean, it was.
Yeah, kind of played out that way. Yeah.
So Morgan comes out with a bat to the ring, and eventually Ronda takes the bat, but just tosses it out because she doesn't need it. And Liv gets trapped in the ring skirt, and then Rousey comes back and gets sprayed with a fire extinguisher and responds with the Piper's Pit on the floor and then swings the bat at Liv's ribs as she comes off the steps. And then Ronda just like gestures into the crowd like she's hit a home run and is healing it up here. The crowd just wants to see a table and throws the gi. Ronda throws the gi jacket at Liv and then whips her with her black belt, ties her around the post and uses the bat. Tables brought into the ring, a chair, and they set up the chair in the corner, but the chair falls down and Rousey gets kicked into the corner, but there's no chair there. And Michael Cole just like covering this up so subtly. Obviously, that would have done a lot more damage if there was a chair there. And Corey's like, yeah, sometimes weapons don't remember that they don't cooperate. It's like, let's call as much attention to this error as humanly possible.
Well, I mean, in a real world sense, I think like it's understandable too, right? But you're right. Like, does not mentioning it.
She still got her shoulder sent into the post. Like, let's just focus on the damage that was done. It's like, well, it could have been a lot worse than what just happened. It could have been into a chair.
Right.
Liv then gets the chair and hands it off to Rhonda like she's going to give her a Van Damminator, but instead hits the double knees that Michael Cole yells, "Code Red!" And Liv then puts Rousey through the table with a senton. This was a much smoother senton than the one we'll discuss later. And gets a two count. And then Rhonda kicks out and goes for the armbar, then into the triangle. Liv lifts her up and does the Quentin Jackson slam. But Rhonda goes back to the armbar, and she's going for the dreaded bicep slicer. And from there, turns it into...
Sorry, please go ahead.
Yeah. It's more of like an inverted triangle that she ends in here.
According to Shayna Baszler, it was a short arm scissor with a go-go plata.
Oh, okay. Well, there you have the technical.
There was a lot of confusion towards the end, but please finish the recap of the match.
So she's got this applied, and they tried to make it like Liv is smiling as she was going out, and she doesn't tap, but she goes unconscious at 12:23. And Rhonda just gets up, and she's total heel afterwards. She's getting booed. She mocks Liv. She's talking trash as she's unconscious, and then steps on top of Liv as she holds her title up. So there was no subtlety here.
She really was heel all match. And, you know,
but she really ramped it up at the end. Like, this was the most heel she got.
Sure. But I don't know, like, when it comes to Rhonda, if I should be looking any deeper into that. Because, like, throughout the entire build, I wouldn't say she really came across as overtly heelish. Yes, she came across as, like, confident and cocky, but, like, never to me, like, being overtly heelish. Like, I wondered how much of tonight was just kind of her reacting to the negative reaction that Philadelphia was giving her, as we've seen her occasionally do, you know, being flustered by negative reaction. Nonetheless, they booked this match with her as, you know, like the clear favorite, with Liv ultimately trying to survive and proving herself to be extreme. How successful that storytelling was, I don't know, John, because I thought there were a lot of faults with this match. You know, prior to some of those final few spots, I would already say the match wasn't all that convincing as a hardcore match. I think the idea of, like, Rhonda coming in, refusing to use weapons because she herself is a weapon, like, it makes sense on paper, but it hardly makes me want to boo her if the intent is to portray her as a heel. Like, if anything, Liv Morgan continuing to use a weapon, like, why am I supposed to cheer for that, you know, against the person who refuses to use weapons? I also felt like the weapon shots that ended up being employed by both looked quite awkward and pretty bad. In particular,
yeah, people were very critical of the chair shots by Liv.
In particular, to me, even the baseball bat shots, you know, honestly, though, like, I'm sure they hurt, like, on some level. Because, I mean, it's, you know,
I don't know if Ron has ever swung a baseball bat either before this.
Well, it's, to me, almost like became the worst of both worlds, because it looked very obvious that they were pulling their shots with these things. And I'm sure they also hurt. So they didn't look good, and they probably also didn't feel great either. I think weapons like baseball bats, you know, but the weapons that we all have a familiarity with in a real world setting, you have to, I think, really use those sparingly, the way, you know, like a Jericho might use Floyd only once in a while. Because a blow from a baseball bat in real life, one shot would be more than enough to lay somebody out. In this match, they were using the baseball bat like it was a jab, you know, like multiple times without any sort of like visual, at least significant visual indicator, like it was doing any damage. So I felt like it ultimately made the baseball bat feel kind of just inconsequential. But even then, I would have still said this was a passable match by WWE sort of plunder standards. But by the time they got to that chair shot, like, or that chair spot in the corner, And just, you know, it, the whole thing falling apart with the attempt at the backcracker, and then the miscommunicated finish. Like, in their minds, yes, we know what they're going for. They're going for Austin Brett, you know, like the baby face that passes out.
This was not Austin Brett.
This was not Austin Brett. Beyond the fact that it's like a brand new submission that, like, none of us would have, even MMA people, like, would have never have, like, understood. Certainly not the live audience. Even your commentator, whose job it is, like Willem Regal did last night on Rampage, you know, communicating the fact that it's not a short arm scissors, it's a bicep slicer. Michael Cole didn't even get the memo that this was supposed to be a chokehold. and not a bicep slicer. So like the drama of her passing out felt confusing. And all I think we were left with afterwards is a lot of people asking, what kind of submission was that? You know, like, anyway, so I thought it was just a poorly communicated match.
Yeah. I like this is not Michael Cole's forte. Like Ronda's going from submission to submission. And again, like this would have been
whose forte it would have been.
Well, yeah. There was one guy that could have been utilized in several of these matches tonight that for whatever reason does not have a job with this company.
But that's no excuse in pro wrestling. Like, shouldn't you be communicating with your commentator beforehand if you're going to do something different? You know?
Especially when it's the finish, you want to convey that. I didn't like the ending either. The idea that she's smiling, that she's going out. I think that's just such a lame finish. This is somehow an admirable trait in a babyface. Like, they did it once with Nikki Cross in NXT losing to Shayna Baszler. Okay, that's Nikki Cross's character. But this one is Liv wanted to prove that she was Ronda's equal and that she's not extreme. Out of her depth here. Well, you ended up out of your depth. You got beat here in clean fashion. You were the lesser of the two. Like, you lost to this woman.
Maybe more so than proving that she was like on Ronda's level. She wanted to prove that she was extreme and that she was capable of like sustaining a great deal of punishment and not submit.
You're losing your championship as we speak. You're smiling as you're going out.
She didn't tap though. You know, it's again, it's. That's
you were caught in a submission. You're going out. You've lost.
Yeah,
you've been checkmated.
It's the moral victory. Of
have you?
Not
did
submitting.
You? Did you ever in your days of jiu-jitsu ever submit someone where they smiled as they were going out?
Well, I have not, but I also haven't faced people with the heart of Liv Morgan.
Did you watch the? Did you watch the Megan Morant interview they put on YouTube afterwards with Liv?
No, no.
So Megan Morant is trying to find Liv Morgan for a word, and she's like in the boiler room, and there is Liv crouched in the corner in the dark with like this crazy look on her face, and she just is like seething. So I don't know where they're going with Liv Morgan.
Okay. Like, so it's a darker turn for Liv Morgan.
That may be what they're doing with Liv from this finish and from based on this digital spot that they put up.
Well, I mean, if she's going crazy and darker, then I think smiling in the midst of a painful submission hold makes kind of makes sense. I guess I just kind of wish that we saw that transformation a little bit more before this, because I feel like in the whole run up to this, I wonder if, like, at least this version of Liv Morgan, I ultimately wonder if she was really ready for this sort of spotlight as a champion. Like, I feel like her matches have kind of been less than impressive, at least for what I consider to be the standard of like top level WWE women's right now, like with Bianca Belair and such. Not to say Ronda is great either, but I mean, Ronda has like sort of her moves at least like can look legit, and she obviously has a lot of mainstream appeal. I think to me, like, Liv Morgan still needs some time, like being ready or maybe finding the right character in order to really feel like a top level star.
And Ronda feels fresher as a heel. So I think you're going with the
again. I'm not convinced we're seeing a heel, Ronda. Like, this might have been a one-night
thing. I
just
see so much of this match was designed in that way. I imagine that's where they wanted this to go at the end. But we'll see what the follow up here is. I don't think you squeeze another match out of this feud. I think we've had our fill.
Yeah, it's over.
The strap match followed that with the Harbinger of Sorrow, Karrion Kross.
You like that one?
Wasn't that your nickname in high school?
The Harbinger of Sorrow, yeah.
Hey, it's the Harbinger of Sorrow. Can you imagine, like, hey, Karrion, actually, call me the Harbinger of Sorrow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think for this character, too, the shaved head is a much better look. This guy is just, this character does not scream, like, product in hair.
Right. I appreciate that, like, he came back with a different look.
He's closer to Maximum Male Model than he is, like, the Harbinger of Sorrow with this hair.
Right. Yeah, okay. You can't be sorrowful with hair.
Cross attacks him before he attaches the strap to his wrist. So they fight into the crowd, and then Cross is, he rams Cross's head into the post, Drew does, and then slides him into the ring, and then finally puts the strap onto Cross. So the bell rings, and he starts whipping Karrion Cross. Fall and pray, bitch. And Scarlett distracts Drew, and this allows Karrion to pull him shoulder first into the post multiple times and then deliver a flatliner onto the desk and whips the shoulder and back of Drew as Scarlett is yelling more, and Cole calls her a sicko. And the crowd is booing this. And at this point of the show, like, I had just seen a million weapon shots with Ronda and Liv Morgan, and there had to have been like 1,000 whippings during this match that I was just numb at this point. And this was the third match of the show. Like, I was totally desensitized to any weapons by the third match into the show. It was just, it seemed too many of these matches was just, we're just going to beat the shit out of each other for as long as possible. And it's that volume of strikes that it just normalizes itself. And it does, it sucks for the performers. Every, the 80th whip is going to be as harmful as the first, but to the crowd, it's just white noise and not the move.
Agreed. Maybe there was a reason why, you know, that opening match between that Donnybrook match received such a great reaction, because you wonder if that match took place three matches deep, how much
like
of a reaction.
Sheamus got dropped on the bar. That was it. There was a moonsault off a barrel. Like,
well,
that
you had Walter.
Oh,
drops,
you had the shillelaghs in that one too. So, never mind. They all relied on weapons.
But still, I'm saying, like, how would a Gunther chop be reacted to when you've seen a million, you know, whips and all that? And that's one of the issues with this Extreme Rules concept, where every match has to have a stipulation. I'll say, like, I feel like they at least did an okay job, I think, of like getting to the stipulations for this cycle. But it points to a problem when you're watching the show itself. You know what? You have to continue to either elevate the bar, not a reference to the match. But you know, a lot of it starts to look the same. And I'll say that was the case with this and the match prior, and also the I Quit match, and of course even the Fight Pit match that relied on a standing eight count.
We'll talk about in that main event. I have a lot. Let me ask you this. If the fireball angle comes off perfectly and he blows off Drew's face, at least that's how it looks, how does that lead to a strap match?
What would it lead to?
Like, in theory, if that angle goes perfectly, like, Drew should be blinded. Like, would that not be the conclusion of that angle?
Remind me why a strap match was suggested.
Drew just called it out. He just wanted a strap match. Like, I don't think there was even a premeditated attack that involved the strap. It was just, that was Drew's, didn't Drew decide?
Yeah, I feel like the strap just kind of came, like, he just, you know.
Like, to me, it's like that fireball angle, like, that almost leads to, like, a blindfold match or something, or something involving one sight, given, you know, what that angle was designed to do.
Anyway, well, he didn't hit the fireball, so there you go.
No, we got this. Doomsday Saito to Drew, which I've got to say, like, the crowd did not react to this as some big finisher. Drew kicks out of it, and then the straps continue, Future Shock to Cross, and then he goes for the Claymore, but Scarlett stops him and shields Karrion, and then she pulls out the dreaded pepper spray. Or as people were joking online, she pulled out the masse and sprayed Drew right in the eyes, leading to the cross hammer, which was a strike to the back of the head, pinning Drew McIntyre in 10 minutes and 23 seconds. If we are judging this with our baseball analogy, I would say maybe they hit a single. I didn't think this was – I just thought the whippings were just really numb by 3 minutes into this match. I thought the finish sucked, and it just did not feel like Karrion Kross came out of this with like a big victory that propels him forward.
I oftentimes like find a match like a strap match or a cowbell match, I find them to be more handicapped than they are, like, you know, I think significant sort of like creative tools. And more than anything, I think they rely on somebody who can make one move essentially look really varied throughout the entire thing, through their charisma, through their actions in between the moves. And I was looking for that from Karrion Kross. I didn't see it, you know, like every time he had control with the straps, like he was just strapping the guy and it wasn't necessarily, it didn't feel like his presence was all that big, beyond the guy just, you know, hitting a move. So if anything, I feel like Drew outshined Cross here, and it's not like Drew was doing anything unique. He's just like, you know, much better at, I think, commanding the crowd's attention. Karrion Kross came across to me from this match the way he's kind of come across to me through his promos. And that's generic. You know, like he needed to prove that he was more than just an entrance in this match. And I didn't necessarily feel that way after this.
Yeah, I just thought this did not accomplish what they wanted it to. And I think it's going to be tough for this Karrion Kross character to get to that next level and what their goals are with the character. When you have sort of this dominant champion, like what are you elevating a Karrion Kross to following this as well? Mm-hmm.
It's one of those gimmicks where like, I can understand like Hunter wanting to bring him back because I think like on the surface, you know, he loves the entrance clearly, you know, he loves the way they look, him and Scarlett together. Like they look like $1 million. But and like when they speak too, like they speak like capable, competent professional wrestlers. But it's that sort of missing special ingredient that I never even really saw in the NXT run, you know, that they probably have to start to try to find right now on the main roster in a big spotlight.
Yeah. So anyway, he falls to pepper spray. So maybe we're going to get that blindfold match out of this somehow. You know, we are going to ruin your vision one way or another.
Fireball, pepper spray, sword match, perhaps.
All right. So Saudi Arabia, there you go. We're going to go for each other's eyes.
Just want to highlight one comment here from the Bloop who says, everybody liked the video. 350 people here, only 35 likes. We're not going to review the rest of the show. We're just going to pause until you guys hit that like button and maybe even subscribe as well. So I hope you like silence, John. I think we got it. We're good.
I could do this all night. The Miz is on the phone with Maryse, and he is making sure nothing goes wrong for their birthday celebration tomorrow. Gritty comes back, and he yells that he's on the phone and storms off, and Michael Cole calls Gritty annoying, just like the Flyers.
Ouch.
Oh. Wait, I mean... Oh. Yeah. Like the Flyers.
Annoying, yeah.
Next match is Bianca Belair and Bayley, ladder match for the Raw Women's Championship. And we saw several of the NXT performers in the crowd with Nikita Lyons here shown. And then later, prior to the main event, Bron Breakker in the crowd. So sort of taking the takeover presentation of guests in the crowd.
Well, this was a historical match, John, you know, first time. WWE singles women's title has been defended in a ladder match. Not that wasn't a Money in the Bank nor TLC match. Oh, historic.
Yeah, put the asterisk next to that. That would have been a mouthful for Michael Cole to explain. Bayley came out, and if you notice, she did have on her wrist tape a tribute there written for Sarah Lee, who passed away earlier this week. The match, early on, there's a running sunset flip that sends Belair to a ladder in the corner and then drives the ladder into Belair's midsection. Then Belair, or Bayley, set up the ladder between the ring and the barricade. Belair is set on top, and Bayley comes off with this running elbow, and this just looked so painful. More for Bayley than it did for even Belair, because it looked like she took most of this on her hip, on the edge of the ladder. I was like, oh my God. So... And this woman is coming off of knee surgery not all that long ago that she missed for a year. So I was watching this match. I was like, she was not going light in this ladder match.
Well, again, John, you know, we're kind of kidding about the sort of whole historical nature of it. But the expectation is there for these two to deliver at a high level because we've seen so many ladder matches, you know, and the fact that this was being portrayed as like a significant moment for the women's division, they needed to absolutely deliver. So the pressure was on for sure.
Bailey then takes off a piece of her knee brace, which Cole is worried that her knee is hurt, but she's just taking off a piece of the brace, but misses and gets hit by the KOD, and the crowd pops. Belair climbs the ladder, and that's when Damage Control runs out, tipping over the ladder, and they bring up that both Asuka and Alexa Bliss are not here because they were injured on Raw. So Belair has no other friends in the locker room. So that's it. These were her two besties that have been taken out. Belair then fights off Sky and Kai, including struggling, but getting both up for a double KOD. And I was just holding my head of just one of these two getting dumped in some awkward position, but she ended up landing it, taking out the two. And then at one point, this ladder had broken in half. So Bailey has the broken piece of one half of the ladder and puts Belair under the main ladder, climbs up, but Belair lifts from underneath, tipping Bailey. They fight on the ladder. Bailey yanks her by the braid, and then Belair pulls her down, whips her with the braid, and lifts up Bailey, who grabs hold of this broken ladder and takes the KOD, dropping herself onto that ladder. And Belair climbs up, grabbing the belt at 16 minutes and 42 seconds. A very high standard when it comes to a ladder match, but I thought in particular the finish came off really well between these two. I have just seen so many ladder matches. I think it's very tough now to try and create a memorable one, but I thought they did a very good job in this match.
I thought so too. I actually thought the match was great, you know, especially with the crowd energy being at a really high level throughout the entire thing. I thought they were really successful in like creating great tension for every single climb to the ladder that I think you saw, especially like when it was Bailey, you know, teasing that she could be winning the whole thing. There are several stunts, as we mentioned, like they had to kind of like, you know, live up to the standard of a ladder match. And I thought they successfully crafted several big spots that, you know, felt pretty organically constructed, like, you know, Bailey doing the cactus elbow off the apron. I thought the double KOD, like as much of a struggle as it was, I thought it felt organic and felt real. And then, of course, that spectacular, completely satisfying finish with the ladder on the KOD. I thought it lived up to high expectations, I felt.
Yeah, they did a really good job. I thought this and the opener were the two top matches of the show. Like they did a really good job. That's when we saw the fan footage of the bunny posing outside with fans. And that takes us to the I Quit match between Edge and Finn Balor. Finn Balor comes out in this sort of a demolition style mask. Maybe
like a gimp mask with spikes on it.
Perhaps, you know, Karrion Kross, this was the backup.
Maybe he's picked up his mask.
Edge to counter came out in the Philadelphia Flyers colors. He was there in black and orange. And
what a betrayal. What the hell? I thought it was supposed to be a Leafs fan.
He's a hockey fan conveniently of whatever state or province he happens to be in. So
of course.
Balor attacks the knee, playing off the attack on television, and it's Balor controlling this for quite a while. Edge then runs both of them through the barricade, and we continually have the referee asking them if they're going to quit. Edge uses a hockey stick for a pop as they fight by the kickoff show set, and uses the hockey stick to put in his mouth for the crossface. I mean, how many hands have been on this hockey stick that you would imagine? I hope this thing was sanitized.
Yeah, and a Philadelphia Flyer, no less.
Just disgusting. They go up the stairs into the crowd, and then Edge runs at Balor for a spear, and it looked like he just ran crotch first into the balcony. I mean, that would have been my, I'm done. I quit. I'm done. I quit. But Edge kind of powered through here. Then Balor uses the chair to the ribs multiple times. Edge is asked, do you quit? Screw you, Finn. And he just hits these brutal shots, these chair shots to the back. Edge then sends Balor into a chair in the corner. This chair remembered its spot and stayed in the corner. And Edge goes after him with chairs and then brings back the worst name submission in Edge's entire repertoire and maybe in WWE history. It is the return of the Edgeducator.
Awful. It's been awful for 20 years.
The Edgeducator. I am going to educate you to my submission. Damian Priest runs down, and this ends the Edgeducator. And then Dominic runs out. Edge spears Balor off the apron onto Priest and Dominic on the floor. This dude's going to be 49 at the end of the month. He's doing this spear spot. Yeah. Crazy. Then he sets up for the spear. Ripley appears. And then, believe it or not, she handcuffs Edge to the top rope. This is always like very could you imagine like just against someone's will, just handcuffing them like that to the top rope, but she managed to do it here. And then the other three re-enter and Edge tries to fight them with one hand free. He is stomped. He is beaten with kendo sticks. Rey Mysterio comes down to his music and fights off Balor and Priest when Dominic nails Rey off the apron to loud boos. The crowd got very heated here. You can say whatever you want about this angle. It is over to this audience, and it's consistent on television and was here. And Michael Cole lost his mind, screaming, "Dominic, he's your father, for God's sake."
I don't know if I've heard this.
Michael Cole is not a yeller, okay? He just, it's awkward when he yells, but when he does, like, it just, it's nails on the chalkboard, but it does suit the moment. Like, it's so out of character. He's your father! Dominic! What are you doing?
I don't know if I've ever heard your Michael Cole.
That's Michael Cole.
You're screaming Michael Cole. I love it. It might be my
Dominic! So, dude, Dominic, I think Dominic's great, okay? He's just, there was more to come with Dominic. So, we get more kendo stick shots from Balor when all of a sudden, Beth Phoenix, like, teleports from North Carolina and she's just here. She's here.
Well, I mean, you know, she can travel fast, yeah.
I mean, it was the opposite of last night. We have the main event of Bound for Glory, and both wives of the main eventers are seated in the front row with their children. They're showing there. They're seated together. Yeah. You just expect, oh, big angle coming. Nothing. Like, yeah. Nothing to do with them at all. Here, we get no sense that Beth is even in this building, and she just appears, like, out of nowhere. So here she is, just hanging out in Philadelphia, and...
Which is cool. Completely unexpected, but it makes total sense why she would be there.
Okay. Would you and your wife just randomly pop up to, like, if you had to work in Milwaukee, okay?
Yeah.
Would your wife just pop up in Milwaukee, like, pack up the kids, we go to Milwaukee? Do you understand what an undertaking that would
be? Of course I do. But, I mean, we don't know the circumstances behind it. Maybe they got a babysitter. Maybe they brought all the kids. Right. Maybe they're hanging out with Maurice and their kids.
Well, Maurice was not there. She was celebrating Mrs. birthday by herself.
Okay.
We learned that. So there is Beth, and she enters the ring, big pop, and it's her and Ripley standing in the middle, and they really like waited for the crowd to get into this, and they go at it. Crowd goes nuts. Beth spears Ripley, gets the key to the handcuff, and frees Edge, who then spears Priest, and then Dominic. Dude, Dominic begs off. He's offering his hand. This was the peak of Dominic. It was awesome. He's just such a smarmy heel here. And Edge shakes his hand and kicks him right in the dick and sends Dominic out. This was terrific.
Same spot as, of course, Cardiff.
Yes, they called attention to. This was his payback. Balor returns and nails Edge with a sling blade. Shotgun dropkick gets stopped with three spears by Edge, and he calls on Beth to get the chair. And she brings the chair to him. He rips off the piece of the chair, applies the crossface, when Ripley blasts Beth with the brass knuckles. Maybe Regal was in the background somewhere after we saw the brass knuckles on TV this week. And then Edge is hit with the South of Heaven. Three coup de grâces are delivered to Edge, and they tell him to quit. He just tells them, go to hell. So instead, they hold up Edge, and Ripley sets up the chairs and is going to deliver a concerto to Beth when Edge realizes this, and he quits. 29 minutes and 55 seconds.
Whoa, that long?
Yes, this went a half hour. And Edge quits. Ripley delivers the concerto anyway, and Edge is devastated. Yeah. I thought overall, I saw a lot of negativity to the length of this match, and I can grant you that. The last like 5-6 minutes of this were exceptionally strong. I would say it was among the probably the most heated outside of Bray showing up of the whole show. Like, they were really into this ending, and I've got to say I thought they overall, like, this match delivered, because the ultimately it was the ending that was the most important. And this crowd, though, they were down throughout parts of the beginning. Like, I think people were kind of looking at their watches, knowing an I Quit match is going long and there's still a lot to come. But by the end, they certainly had this crowd.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe I wasn't as cognizant of the link because I came out of the match like buzzing so much from that finish. You know, it's not every day that I feel like, you know, professional wrestling creates like such a intense dramatic scene, and I thought they absolutely achieved that here at the end. I thought the use of Beth, the fact that we hadn't seen Beth for quite a little while and had no idea that she was even going to be a part of this angle, and then her popping up being used the way she was, I think is, you know, yes, it's a bit of a trope, like in having sort of like, you know, the female compatriot of the male getting attacked to push the male story. But I hope it means that this is Beth coming into the story, because now I really want to see that Beth versus Rhea Ripley match. If you're talking about a mixed tag setting, fine, I'll even take that. But like Beth Phoenix, to me, coming out of this feels really hot. And I want to see her back in ring, especially against Rhea now more than ever. I thought the first half of the match was definitely flat, you know, and it was about maybe as kind of awkward as like many I Quit matches tend to go, because we have to pause the action to hear a man breathing hard on a microphone being amplified in an entire arena. And
they could have cut some of those out in the beginning. Yeah. 10 minutes. It's like,
yeah, we know like, you know, Edge isn't,
I got put
quitting
through a barricade.
Yeah, we know Edge isn't quitting off of like, you know,
he literally
body
had
scissors.
Like a half crab on him, and it was like, okay,
yeah,
like they could have cut out some of those.
Yeah, yeah. And the crowd wasn't obviously buying anything like a figure four, for instance. But once they got into the run-ins, I thought it got really good, you know, especially when Ray came in, especially with all the stuff with Dominic, which continues to really impress me with how well it's working. And especially once Beth came in and the incredibly dramatic, well-constructed finish that they created for Edge. I thought Edge's like acting in a wrestling sense, I thought was really well displayed here towards the end. But like when he says I quit at the end, you know, it wasn't kind of like you're expected. I quit. It was more like, I quit. Like it would no hesitation. He was suddenly being shocked with the visual image of his wife about to get her head smashed in. And I thought he played that perfectly. So I love it. I love the, like this entire thing. Judgment Day suddenly feels like the most evil, like legitimate, like, you know, like, you know, worst group of people on this show.
They've done a fantastic job resurrecting Judgment Day, which was a group that was DOA like five months ago.
Totally.
So yeah, I thought by the end, like, it certainly, but by the end, I think you, for the story, I think you have to call it a success by the end. But I echo your sentiment that it was probably too long. And in the beginning, like this crowd was down for a good portion of it. Miz walks up to Hunter's office. He has found it after 2 hours and 2.5 hours. Gritty is still there with the shirt. So Miz attacks Gritty. Loomis appears, chokes out Miz, and puts Miz out next to Gritty, helps up Gritty, who kicks Miz, and Dexter Loomis leaves with Gritty. So we got these segments throughout the night, and what a payoff at the end.
Yeah, pretty lame, you know, all said at the end of it, but it's okay. Inoffensive, at least it's not a match.
I was offended greatly. The Fight Pit is the main event, Seth Rollins and Matt Riddle with Daniel Cormier as the special referee. They showed Bron Breakker in the audience and plugged the NXT on Tuesday nights. And the match begins. So we've got they are in the cage with the elevated platform as well. We will talk about this elevated platform. And very early, the crowd starts chanting, "We want Wyatt." And I thought these chants were going to persist, but they were pretty much contained to just that portion at the beginning. Then they started with Rollins' theme on it. Like, this was a crowd, they wanted to fast forward to Bray Wyatt.
I got that sense for sure. I think, you know, by the time the main event came around, everybody was ready for the real main event, and that was Bray. But I will say, like, the presentation of the Fight Pit, like, felt big, certainly bigger than it was in an NXT. I feel like they've kind of dressed it up a bit, put some LEDs on it, and made it feel like you get the sense they're trying to, like, build another Hell in a Cell / Elimination Chamber that they can use as sort of a gimmick. And presentation-wise, I thought it was cool. Did you catch Michael Cole? A very interesting point where he said, you know, Daniel Cormier hasn't beaten Jon Jones, but you know who has? Matt Riddle.
tell Michael Cole about that that story point, Jimmy.
Of course, this was, you know, what Jimmy Smith revealed to be his tipping his tip that he was not going to be calling this match, and that he had probably going to be let go.
He had this note that he gave to Paul Levesque, and Levesque noted to him on Monday at Raw. Tell Cole about that. That's a good line to use. Yeah. I was amazed that they still use the line.
I know.
It's like, there's our parting gift from Jimmy Smith is we'll work this line into it. So anyway, Rollins hit a Showtime kick, which I guess Corey Graves noted, eat your heart out, Benson Henderson. So people were quick to point out that it was Anthony Pettis who hit the Showtime kick on Benson Henderson.
It was not the Bendo kick. No.
Sometimes people can, anyway,
close enough.
I mean, it's like, come on, the guy's just like rattling this off the top of his head. We can give people a break. Riddle applies a triangle. So Rollins gouges his eye, and then Rollins shoves Cormier out of the way. So Cormier grabs Seth and puts him against the fence and instructs him, don't touch me. The fight is with Riddle, not with me. Rollins then hits a stomp.
I hated that.
Okay.
Because, like, for one thing, it was like, I mean, it was like ground and pound, wasn't it? And then, like DC kind of caught, like, a, you know, like, I don't know, some contact from Riddle. But that's on DC to not walk into the fight, you know? Like, why is DC pulling a guy off to say, don't punch me, when he clearly walked into the punch himself?
Well, from there, Rollins hits the stomp, and then Cormier goes to check on Riddle instead of counting, and the announcers are calling this out. They're like, why isn't he counting? And then after checking on Riddle, then he starts the count.
Rollins, what was that? What the hell was that?
Okay, I had so many questions about some of these rules and the counting procedure. So
it's more so like, the it way was just inconsistent with DC, with what he was doing before. I didn't even realize it was supposed to be like a standing 10, you know? I guess I'd forgotten. Like, was the last fight pit like this too?
You could do the counts. Yeah. So
you can't pin, or you can't like you.
Yeah, it was like knockout or submission.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
So Rollins then climbs up onto the platform above the ring, and Cormier is yelling at him to get down. And my question would be, why? Why do we have this platform if you're not allowed to go up there? Why would he be telling him to come down? This is specifically built. This isn't like you're breaking the structure to go on top of the cage. This is literally part of the apparatus. Why would we not be allowed to go up there? So he's just continually telling Rollins to come down. Then Riddle climbs up, and Corey is asking, can he win the match up there? And Cole says, no, he can't. So what is the point of this area if you can't win it up there? Like, why does it exist?
For you to do cool dives off of.
Well, this became so goddamn confusing, and I don't think I was alone, because I think they, the performers, I think were unaware of this, because Rollins hits a buckle bomb, but into the fence on top, and then a pedigree on the platform, and Rollins is screaming at Cormier to count. Cormier's explaining he can't count when they're up there, and this did not feel like a heel that felt he was being wronged. It just felt like we're trying to build drama for this ending, and like we just wasted a spot is what it felt like to me. But this just felt like it was just bizarre. Like, we're not doing counts up here, but we're doing these teases of finishes up there.
Yeah, I feel like this was one where I probably shouldn't have skipped over like the opening video. I don't know if you happen to watch it, John, the sort of like preview video ahead of the match. Like, did they actually explain all of this?
Well, not apparently, because Corey Graves was asking these questions.
Yeah, because like I like throughout the entire build, I don't know how well they really communicated the fight pit rules. I was just under the impression that this was essentially like, you know, sort of like MMA rules or pseudo MMA rules, you know, submit or get knocked out. I didn't realize it was like a standing 10. And then I suppose the rule of like not being able to, you know, submit somebody when they're on the scaffold, that wasn't a point that they really explained until we got into that circumstance. But yeah, I could certainly see the crowd getting confused.
So he's yelling at Cormier to count. After that, we see Rollins is able to, or he tries for another stomp. Riddle sidesteps and he hits an RKO, and Rollins like as gingerly as possible, rolls off the platform down into the ring. And Cormier, so Rollins is down on the ground and he's counting Rollins, but then Riddle starts to like make a pose. So Cormier stops his count as Rollins is down. He's on his back, but Cormier has stopped the count. Rollins is down for a 10 here. But Riddle jumps off the platform and he comes down with this senton. And were you going to play it?
Yeah, just the call.
This sound will be in the back of my mind for the rest of my life because it was the most painful sounding landing I can recall two individuals having. It was such a clunk that it just sounded terrible.
You
it just
hear
sounded
it?
Like let's just play it.
Get out, you crazy man!
Did he say holy bro?
He said float.
that sounded pretty legit.
It sounds way worse like when you're just listening to it. He said floating bro. Floating
I
bro.
Don't know if we have serious injuries coming out of this, but they like Rollins managed to get up. I thought Rollins took the worst of this, but Riddle could have as well. It sounded horrible.
Oh my God.
It's like Riddle's footing looked off when he came off, and it was just like the distance and the height did not compute for this to land smoothly, and it looked like Rollins took all of this.
Would you honestly say this didn't land smoothly? Because considering, I think, the type of move, it looked like a pretty – okay, I'm not going to say clean because, like, look at the point of contact here. You
Dude,
know,
like, it looked like
a lot of weight.
He came right down on Rollins. That's what it looked like in real time.
Sure, but I mean, it looked similar to the way you would expect a senton landing to be like. Now, would you do a senton to somebody from that high up, even if, like, you know, if the contact was like that? God, no. Like, this was a crazy spot. You know, we've seen people do, like, moonsaults. We've seen people do, like, superfly splashes, of course. But, like, this move, I mean, we see Jeff Hardy do this often, too. But, God, like, I feel like this was the clearance is, like, so he was so far away and, like, he definitely.
You didn't even have like a table to like absorb, you know, some of it. It's just like there's nowhere for Rollins to go here. He just has to eat it all. Rollins does get up and he manages like to powerbomb him into the cage. But then, boom, Riddle applies a triangle and Rollins taps like moments later at 15:36. It felt like they just went right to the finish after this. It felt very anticlimactic.
Really? You think so? You think like maybe because of injury or maybe because of time? Like I don't know if I necessarily got that sense. Like, I mean, because this was a fight pitch pseudo MMA match, like I suppose a submission victory kind of made sense. But you know, it was certainly a bit flatter because I think this was an audience that never recognized the triangle as a Matt Riddle finisher. It felt
awkward way because Rollins has just taken the most devastating move here with this senton, but then he's the one that gets up and power bombs him into the fence. So it's like he gets this big offensive maneuver in instead of just Riddle hits the senton and then boom, submits him from this. Like you had that transition spot where it's like Rollins gets up and looks like he's recovered from the senton. And then we go to the finish.
Yeah, perhaps.
It was almost like it negated the senton when he got back up to his feet.
I mean, he countered a triangle, you know, with the buckle bomb. So, like, maybe the triangle woke him up and gave him sort of an extra burst of adrenaline. Nonetheless, it seems like this match, the response to it, from what I'm gathering from you, John, is that it wasn't maybe that great. And for me, though, like, I see how hard these two worked in this match, you know, like they were up on that scaffold and I thought they actually did a really good job teasing the tension of people falling off. They came up with a number of like, you know, interesting sequences, teasing people falling off. And I think simply like attempting things like a running buckle bomb on that scaffold, like scared the shit out of me, you know, like the margin of error, must be so small for something like that. So for them to do all that, I thought they did a pretty good job. I was surprised, in fact, that the reaction live wasn't as much. And I wondered if like maybe the sight lines don't make it look as impressive as it does, like with the camera right inside, perhaps, and seeing like the distance between the pit and where they can fall.
Yeah, it would be interesting. Like they, you know, remember like the fight pits in NXT, it's a much smaller venue to watch it from. In here, it would be interesting. Like, yeah, what the visual was like for people in the crowd to see this.
Yeah, yeah. So, I thought they did actually about as tremendous of a job with this, you know, kind of awkward structure as I could expect two human beings to pull off. I think the fault is in explaining some of these rules, which probably shouldn't have been as convoluted as they were. The role of Daniel Cormier kind of perplexed me. It's like, I don't know if they were trying to tease some sort of cahoots with him and others, but I thought it was poorly communicated if there was any sort of tease like that. Ultimately, he was just sort of like, you know, neutral party. But like, I just don't think anything he did.
No. And I mean, they were calling it out. Like, he wasn't counting when the viewer at home is like, he's down, you should be counting. Like, they weren't even consistent with their own rule set. I don't know. Like, certainly Daniel Cormier, he brought them some attention, I think, by being part of this. But it just didn't feel like a big kind of, like, I don't know if people are salivating after this of seeing a follow-up angle or something like that involving Daniel Cormier. Like, I don't think he left that impression.
I don't think so either. Like, he came out of this, I mean, just as another referee. Like, nothing all that special about it. Now, do you feel like coming out of this, how do you feel about the fight pit concept? Do you think there's any interest in, you know, a return to the
I think that you could revisit it in the right situation, but I think you kind of have to tighten up some of the things. Like,
what is the fight pit? What is the appeal? Like, to me, it's a scaffold match, you know? Like, that's the only real draw to it. The fact that you could have two people fight from atop and possibly fall
off. Yeah, but
if
you climb to the top, you are admonished by the referee that you must come down. You're not supposed to go up there.
You're not supposed to be up there, but that's the only appeal. To me, like, the MMA nature of it, like, I don't think was all that special. Like, what was MMA about this beyond the fact that it's a cage? You know, they should probably abandon that and just call it a scaffold match or something like that.
Yeah, I think that they will probably try this concept again. But I think you would want to take, like, it just felt very awkward at a lot of different points in this. I don't think this one was executed all that great. I wouldn't say this was a successful rendition of it for me.
Yeah, yeah. It was certainly awkward, maybe, you know, not helped by the fact that this was a crowd that was expecting Wyatt, and that probably took away some of it too. But I have to commend these two for like the incredible amount of like athleticism and risk that they took
some of those spots. They were very, very hard in the match. I think it was more so, you know, working around this concept that I think, like, the concept shouldn't dictate the you know, it shouldn't be such a hindrance that you have to work around it. And I think sometimes this fight pit became something like it was an obstacle for them instead of enhancing the match.
Yeah, yeah. If they built this as like, oh, two people can climb up on that structure and they could fall 30 feet below and you know, come to great damage, like that might have been more interesting than like this whatever MMA thing that they're trying to push.
Like, think about the fact that you had on the top platform, Riddle takes the pedigree. Mm-hmm. It's way more dramatic if you're doing the count and Riddle beats the count to get back up from a pedigree. Conversely, Rollins getting up from the RKO. Like, the only reason to do those spots in this type of a match is the drama of the other one beating the count. And they had no count. It was like wasted moves.
I hate the idea of a count in a match like this.
Well, that was the whole basis of this thing, because the count was everything.
But it's just like, why would there even be a count? Like,
you can win by knockout, and that is their way of conveying a knockout. It's not going to be just, you know, you're out cold and the guy's just waving it off. It's like, it's going to be knockout or submission.
I see. Okay.
Which is fine. And for a setting like this, where you're doing big moves, like, you want to promote the drama, and a 10 count is going to be dramatic. That's fine. But the two big finishers that were used were in this area that you can't execute the count and generate that drama from the crowd to count along and have the person stagger to their feet. You should have done those in the ring then. And I think that's where there was some kind of miscommunication of, you know, doing these counts, because it just seemed like you wasted these moves and these opportunities to build up the, the hype for the match.
Right. Yeah. And in either case, seems like they might need to retool this, at least, you know, communicate some of the rules a little bit more effectively for the audience. But what did you guys think of the Fight Pit? What did you guys think of Extreme Rules? At this point, we go and take your feedback. We invite people who are double ice captain and special patrons to call in. You can find that link in your email. Otherwise, we will go to forum.postwrestling.com. And of course, super chats here at youtube.com/postwrestling. You want to start off with some super chats, John?
Let's start.
Okay, let's go first of all to Sin City Saint, who sends $10. Thank you so much for the support, Sin City Saint. He says, I feel like the WWE has too much talent to focus on now. It's going to be rough all around, especially with Randy and Cody returning at some point. Lots of cards in the deck to play. What are your thoughts? Too much talent?
That to me is not a terrible problem to have, and especially when you have as much television as WWE has to fill every week. When you have 3 hours on Monday and two on Friday, I would not be complaining about having too much talent that are especially stars. And I think you would classify Randy and Cody as stars. So I'm not too worried about that. But inevitably, like, they are signing all these people, bringing people back. There is going to be, you know, people that are not, this is a honeymoon period in WWE. And there will be a period when, you know, there's not going to be television time for everybody to go around, or prominent stories for everybody. There are going to be tiers of talent, and there's going to be, you know, the maximum male models, and then there's going to be the more emphasized acts as well. So in time, that will sort of play itself out. But, you know, that's going to be in any company. I would never want to shy away from having, you know, too much.
Yeah, you want to have options, right? Having too much talent is never a problem, but choosing to focus on too many at once and, you know, confusing storylines by showing everybody, I think can be a problem. And to me, that's the problem I'm seeing with AEW right now. They're trying to feature too many people, and I think not giving enough airtime to the people that are that need it the most in order to just tell, like, you know, a few cohesive stories rather than giving a little bit to every single person. So it's more of a test on, I think, how, like, I don't know, discipline perhaps, like the WWE can be, and how focused they can be. And we don't exactly know yet, because it's still a relatively new creative regime. Thank you for the support, Sin City Saint. We got a John Cena who sends $2 to say, angry Michael Cole is my new favorite Pollock voice. We might have a winner
with Dominic. He was outraged.
Maybe the two opposites, you know, the yin and the yang. You have Dominic and you have angry Michael Cole. Yes. And then finally, we got a Jake. Jake from the Windy City says, tonight is the real main event, the Japanese Grand Prix in Shizuoka.
Yeah, it starts off in 20 minutes.
Wow. Okay. We better get this thing, get the show on the road. Let's do some phone calls here from our post-wrestling double ice cap and espresso patrons. Let's start off here with Hanzi. Hanzi, welcome to the show.
What's going on, man? What's it called? Yeah, no, I thought the opening match was really good, and I thought the last bit of the last man standing and the main event, the ladder match was fine. It just, I've seen enough ladder matches, and I don't think you're going to impress me with, like, I mean, between all these companies that do ladder matches, you know what I mean? I'm seeing them all the time, so I wasn't really as much a, like, a...
Seen a women's ladder match for a WWE title, Hanzi?
Yeah, I guess you got me. I mean, I always hate the semantics where they go, this is the first women's ladder match, when I literally seen so many like the fact you don't call Money in the Bank match a ladder match. It's like it just takes me out when they try to do semantics with stats and all that. With the Cross and Drew thing, I gotta be honest. I've not been to Cross's character ever since Adam Cole roasted him about, like, what makes you so special? You know what makes me special? When they ring the bell, I think that, like, that promo was like the Rock and Billy Gunn moment for me, at least. I've never really been into Cross as much after that, and I don't know. I gave it a chance, and it wasn't really that great. I understand they needed to do a couple of gimmicks. And again, you guys have been more favorable towards Judgment Day, and I haven't, in the sense that like, even though they get good beatdowns, they haven't had, like, super definitive victories. And I always think that's kind of weak, but after tonight, this is probably the first time that I really think there's heat to the group and how Michael Cole reacted and all that kind of stuff. And I thought that was really great. There was someone who posted online on Twitter about Liv Morgan. After the match, it didn't show it on television, but she was sitting there just laughing uncontrollably for a couple of minutes. So maybe they're doing like a Harley Quinn character or something like that. But that's the impression that I got from what people are saying. But the main event for me was like the Bray Wyatt stuff. I think, you know what, it's probably a good decision because people might get mad that he didn't go to AEW, but I think in WWE, he probably fits that mold better. And somebody said that, I'll leave after this, but somebody said that because like, there's so many hidden things there, that rabbit backwards is Tabar, so people think that T-Bar is going to be one of the guys in the stable or something like that. I go on Reddit a lot, so I mean, these are the theories that you read on there. But,
it felt like a joke to me.
But you guys did a good job, and I just thought, it's fine, whatever. But I thought the pay-per-view was pretty decent, but it wasn't the best pay-per-view. But the Bray Wyatt stuff was probably phenomenal. I missed the guy. I'm a fan of the guy. I know he's not everyone's cup of tea, but I'm willing to give it a new chance. And I'm glad that he stuck with WWE because I don't think I want him in AEW because then people would have complained that it's just too much sports entertainment. I think it fits. I got to see how this plays out. But anyways, I might see you guys in Dynamite if you guys are in Toronto. I'm going to Rampage too. I got a ticket like $10 for Rampage, a floor seat for it because the tickets were like really really low price.
How did you get that? Did you just get it from Ticketmaster, like the $10 seat?
No. I went to StubHub, and a lot of the tickets were like $11, $6.
You can get the Rampage pretty cheap.
I just go, you know
Thursday.
What? They don't come to Canada often.
Okay.
What's that?
Cool. Nothing. We're on a delay, Hanzi, but I thank you so much for the call. Appreciate it. And maybe we will see you because we are doing a very informal meetup in front of the Tim Hortons at 171 East Liberty Street, right before Dynamite on the Wednesday, 5 p.m. Eastern. So if you're listening to us, you want to hang out, grab a coffee, grab a sleeve from Post Wrestling, come see us 5 p.m. Eastern time, right before Dynamite. 171 East Liberty Street. Don't tell them about it. Like, don't walk into Tim Hortons and be like, where's the Post Wrestling meetup? Because, like,
they'll have us arrested. So,
they don't know anything.
Keep it on the down low.
What did Hanzi talk about? I'm sorry.
Rampage tickets. You can get it. You can get it on StubHub. $8 tickets to get into Rampage right now.
Oh my goodness. Wow. He brought up like a number of like maybe a Dijak. I think Dijak would be wonderful to see as part of a bigger stable. He certainly needs something right now if he's going to be any sort of player, you know, under the leadership. The Bloob here sends a $2 super chat to say Cross, Alexa, Gacy all had Bray moments. Could they be a part of Bray's new squad?
Yeah, I mean, you could throw in any of those names. The Nikki Cross one was thrown out. You know, Dexter Lumis could fit into there in some form.
I wonder. I wonder what a stable will be like. Obviously, the Wyatt family, you know, was a great thing for them. But certain people, I think, could run with it. I don't know if I see Joe Gacy like benefiting from like being behind Bray. Like, he's not bigger than Bray Wyatt, so he doesn't like feel like an enforcer or muscle type. Alexa, I want her far away from all this stuff, you know, like I think there's way more value in her being like, you know, not attached at all to this hocus pocus stuff, at least in the long term. Nikki Cross, sure, why not? Like, she's not doing anything else, you know, better than the superhero thing. Thank you so much for the support, Bloop. Let's go up next to New Jersey and a guy that we might also see on Wednesday. Brandon, oh my goodness, talk about uncontrollable laughter.
What's going on, man? Forgive me. I'm according to you from this week, John, I'm three deep in a couple shots of bourbon from the Phillies.
Well, I call him like I see him. Did we lose Brandon already? Okay, he's gone.
Yeah, I don't know. He's like the Fiend. He just pops up and then tune in on Monday.
Yeah.
Okay. That's it? Seriously?
We got a visual image there. That's Brandon. Maybe we'll see him this week. We will see. All right. Any more calls, Way?
No more calls. Forum.postwrestling.com now, where all of our patrons at postwrestlingcafe.com can leave their written feedback. You want to start, John?
Saeed from Vancouver. The show was very hit and miss. Started with two fun matches, but then the strap match was very boring before the show picked up again. Hope Bailey is okay after the KOD and the ladder smoked her in the mouth. What an ending. I honestly thought the show was over after the graphic, but Hunter loves those post-graphic angles. Bray is so damn creative. Very interested to see where this goes. Time to make dinner. Enjoy some F1.
All right. A lot of F1. Will Max Verstappen clinch it tonight?
Yeah. I wish we were on the West Coast. This would make it a much more enticing time.
We got a Brandon from Oshawa who says, this was a really good show with a terrible crowd that should have been much hotter than just for certain spots. Edge and Balor was my match of the night, and I'm glad they found a creative way to give Finn the win. He needed it much more. My favorite moment of the night was Cole shouting at the White Castle of Fear strap match from Super Brawl 3. Do you guys think Bray's life-size puppets get reveals of actual people? Yeah. That is speculation. I'd go as far as to say maybe that's the expectation at this point.
I mean, if they're introducing them the way they did tonight in the crowd, that sort of would be the next step, like his revealing who these people are showing up in the crowd. I mean, that would seem to make sense. Next one is Benjamin. The Brutes versus Imperium was damn good. These six have such great chemistry. Kind of reminds me of what the Hardys, Dudleys, and Edge and Christian did for each other. Video packages were great. Glad Bray Wyatt is back.
Kate from Montreal, who joined me on last night's Rewind of SmackDown, says the Bray reintroduction was absolute perfection at the end of a pretty tepid show. None of the matches were memorable, and most felt like they went too long, with the exception being Rollins versus Riddle, which felt like it was kicking into high gear when it finished. Now we get to find out once and for all if Wyatt can pay off the enormous promise his characters have always shown. He definitely has my attention.
I think he has everyone's attention. I think everyone is curious to see what the steps are, and this will be a lot on, and there's probably collaboration, but it is going to fall on Paul Levesque's shoulders, I think, a lot in terms of the handling of it. Verus from Malaysia, thumbs in the middle show, amazing opening six-man, perhaps set the bar too high for me with the next two matches. A clunky Ronda Liv match and lackluster Cross versus Drew match were downers. It picked back up with a decent ladder match between Bianca and Bayley. However, Finn and Edge went too long, but Cole's call and the fridging finish saves it for me. Riddle and Rollins was an okay match in my book, and that insane senton spot. Bray's reveal was amazing at the end. Can't wait to see what is in store with Bray, not under the creative control of Vince McMahon moving forward. 6 out of 10.
Fridging being a reference to in comic books when the female character, female associate of a male character is, harmed, to further a male character story. That courtesy of W.H. Park on this week's MCU Later. So if you want a full explanation of what fridging is and the origins from Green Lantern Comics, you can listen to this week's She-Hulk review up in the Post Wrestling Cafe. And I know, John, you were about to say all that. So let's go to Manny from Pacoima, who says, really good show. Imperium versus the Brawling Brutes was a great opening match. I wouldn't want to piss off any of those guys. Sign Gritty to NXT. He says the ladder match was amazing as well. Bianca and Bayley gave it their all, with Bianca besting all of Damage Control. By the time the Fight Pit match was over, I had completely forgotten about the White Rabbit, but he's here. What a way to bring him back. The crowd was going nuts, and I had goosebumps all over. Can we assume the Wyatt Six will all be active wrestlers? Bray Wyatt is back. Also, props to Cena and Kate for helping out with the post shows, and shout out for Way and John's White Rabbit Conspiracy Corner. You're all invited to the Carne Asada. Oh, wonderful. Love Carne Asada. Okay, so I didn't even put together that there were six. How many were there, John? Can we confirm the number of characters that were appearing?
No.
No, I got just to, what so we got Huskus, we got the Ostrich, we got Ramblin' Rabbit, we got Abby, and then we've got the Fiend. So those are five, plus Bray makes six.
So Bray and Fiend are not one in the same.
I guess not. And what was the thing on the desk? Was it some sort of mask on Cole and Graves' desk?
Yeah, that's what it looked like. With so the is that coming out.
Is that one of the six?
Sure. Well, yeah. Add to it. Yeah.
All right. Whatever.
There's many. Okay. Nas from New York. I just want to completely fanboy over that Bray Wyatt return. It was so awesome. Just an incredible shout out to everyone behind the creation of this, to everyone who dived into the rabbit hole, to Way with his incredible commentary for us listeners, and to watching John reacting to Way's commentary. Such a feel-good return. Hope he shows up at Barclays Center on Monday.
Thank you for the kind words. It was certainly fun. I love these sort of puzzles, and something tells me that all of that's kind of done with now that we've kind of got the reveal. But I do hope that, like, you know, the character and the show itself continues to operate on that sort of, like, you know,
this was a very successful concept way that you can point to actual numbers and such of this working, that I have no doubt in my mind they will take, not verbatim what they did here, but elements of this and sending people online and doing more hidden things. And I think realizing that even if a small percentage of our audience puts all these pieces together, it's going to explode online to our most ardent wrestling fans that are going to follow this stuff through others discovering it, that enough buzz is going to build at that level. And to the ones that don't follow it, we can do the, hey, tomorrow night, the White Rabbit's here, like at the end, and that kind of just blankets everybody. So I think you take this away, this was a very successful promotion.
Agreed. Our last piece of feedback comes to us from Chris from Ottawa, who somehow always seems to get the last word. He says, I swear this isn't recency bias. Screaming Michael Cole, in my mind, moves ahead of Anderson Silva and into the number one spot on the John Pollock Impressions countdown. Wow, that is high praise for a Pollock impression. I mean, it might be up there, you know. By the way, everybody, at Archive Away, Brad the Archivist is doing 31 days of John Pollock impressions if you follow at Archive Away right now. I believe we just went through – who did we go through, John? We did Dominic. I believe we did Gene LaBelle recently.
I don't know. This account's blocked.
He says Extreme Rules 2022 also gets a 10 out of 10 because of this. Well done. Okay. Well, there you go.
I don't know why the show should benefit from our post show at all.
One last super chat here. And this comes to us from Felipe from Chile, who sends 2,500 Chilean pesos. We could retire on this. He says, I hope Wyatt returns and delivers more than the rain in Japan right now.
Oh, is it raining?
Apparently. Yeah. Which means a fun race. Slicks are intermediates. Wets are intermediates. I'm asking you.
You're asking me.
He says he's following away with the bear. Love from Chile. Yes. Thank you, Felipe. Yeah. A lot of people watching the bear as a result of our recommendation. It's a great show.
All right. On that note, I've got to wake up in 4 hours, everybody. So I am going to say goodnight to everybody. But thank you for tuning in to our Extreme Rules post show. Everybody joining us live in the chat room. When are we back, Wei? When are we doing? When are we talking again?
We are back on Monday, but only if all 335 people in here right now hit the like button. Otherwise, we are quitting.
I'm taking Monday off. It's a holiday.
We're never doing a show again until we get 339 likes off of this video. And if you're watching this after the fact, listening to this after the fact, leave a nice review. Don't be one of those guys leaving a review about how we're so woke. We're just like so many of our reviews lately, John, are just like, wow, look at these guys. They're such SJWs. Do us a favor, everybody. Counter them. Tell us how horrible people we are, but make sure you give us a 5-star. Okay, just you know, get us up there. Leave a review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher. Hit the like button, subscribe. Whatever you do, just make us look good, everybody.
You do as Wei said, everybody. So yeah, maybe we'll have a show Monday night. Maybe we won't. You can. That's up to you. You
check.
Truly have the power, and we will find out. All right, thanks everyone for joining us, and that concludes the Extreme Rules post show. We're out.